Good morning. Hi, I'm T.W. Davis. I'm the youth pastor here at High Point Fellowship, and I also get to serve on our preaching team. And so I'm so excited to be able to bring you the word today. A week ago, I spent a week in Colorado Springs up on top of a mountain. It was at 9,200 feet, and so obviously there was some acclimation to get used to, but it was a retreat for youth pastors, and one of the things that we were able to do every day was to hike. The first day, I decided that I was going to hike a peak called Inspiration Point. Now, there's a trail that goes to Inspiration Point and then goes beyond to a whole nother mountain, right? So the longer I hiked, I could see the top that I was trying to get to, the peak I was trying to get to. The longer I hiked, I could see it from a distance. I hiked and I hiked and I finally got to the bottom of this mound that I had to climb. I saw a trail that circled around and started going down. I saw a trail that kept going toward the next mountain. And so I thought, all right, I'm here. And I have no way to get to the top, but here we are. So I found the spot that felt the least steep, and I started climbing. Now, I knew this was a intermediate rappelling area, so I knew there were some holds at least. So I climbed, and then I got about halfway up, and I realized I'm by myself. This is against everything the Boy Scouts taught me on hiking, on climbing, on doing anything outdoors. There's no cell phone service. There's no nobody around. If I fall, no one's going to find me for a while. But I was already halfway up, so I decided to keep going. I'm not saying that was the smart thing to do. I'm just saying that's what I did. I made it to the top, and it took a ton of energy. I mean, I was exhausted by the time I made it. The elevation was a problem. The exertion meant that when I got to the top, man, I was exhausted. But the view was outstanding. I'm going to show you a picture of what it looked like while I was up there, right? It was totally worth the exertion and the soreness the next day. Sometimes the things we go through are worth it in the end, right? It's not pleasant when we're going through it, but the end result is beautiful. When I was on top of that peak, I was reading and I was praying and I was thinking about suffering. Because that's what we're talking about today, is suffering. The question for today, our series in 1st and 2nd Peter has been called, But What About? And today's question is, but what about suffering? Dan touched on this a little bit last week and he talked about doing the right thing, and sometimes doing the right thing is suffering. Sometimes we suffer because it's someone else's fault. Sometimes we suffer because we have made a mistake. It's our fault. That rock that I climbed, it was beautiful when I got up there, right? But when I got to the top, after I exerted all that energy, got to the top, was totally exhausted, I looked, and if I had walked around the mound a little bit, there was a trail that walks right up it. I didn't have to climb if I had just looked. This spot, the other way was much safer. It was easier to get to. And it wouldn't have cost me near as much energy. See, I had not evaluated the situation correctly. So I dangerously climbed the face of a cliff rather than take the trail. The view was beautiful at the end, but I had suffered needlessly. And trust me, I suffered. See, this is not the suffering we're talking about today. Today we're talking about when Peter is talking about suffering because we are Christians. Fred read it or recited it for us earlier, but the start of this section is one of my favorites, and it makes me chuckle. I imagine Peter writing this kind of as a, are you serious? Peter says, Dear friends, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal that has come on you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. Don't be surprised when something bad happens. Don't act like you're surprised when you suffer because you're a Christian. If you're surprised, someone didn't explain Christianity to you very well. After all, our entire religion is based on a faith, and the crux of our religion, crux of our salvation, revolves around a man who was humiliated. He was homeless. He was mocked. He was beaten. He was executed Right? This is the person that we hold so high. This is the person that we revere. This is the person from whom the name of our religion is derived. Christian means little Christ. In fact, the term Christian itself started out as a derogatory term given the way that Jesus had been treated. Peter says, "But rejoice inasmuch as you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. If you're insulted because of the name of Christ, you are blessed. For the Spirit of God, the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. If you suffer, it should not be as a murderer or thief or any kind of criminal or even as a meddler. However, if you suffer as a Christian, do not be ashamed, but praise God that you bear that name." See, we're not talking about the suffering that comes from sin or suffering that comes from living in this sinful world. We're talking about the suffering that comes from bearing the name Christian. But not just bearing the name Christian, living it out. Some places in this world, that suffering looks like persecution, true physical persecution. This is 100% still happening in the world that we are part of presently. But we live in America, the home of the free, where this is not the normal. It still happens, but it's not happening to everyone all the time. See, this is both a blessing and a curse. See, I gotta be honest, I don't want to suffer a martyr's death. That sounds awful. Yet Peter's saying that we must suffer to be a Christian. That is the call. That is what we signed up for. So if the government or your neighbors or whoever else is not coming into your house, grabbing you and killing you unceremoniously for being a Christian, then what does being a Christian, what does suffering as a Christian look like in suburban Cedar Park? What does suffering look like for a Christian in our situation? See, you're not going to like it, but we're called to suffer, and we got to make the choices and follow Jesus that inevitably lead to suffering. So let's talk about four of the paths that lead to suffering in our reality, right? I decided to go the old school preacher route, right? So I've got 4 points on what suffering looks like, and they're all starting with a P, because that's how it used to be done. And so these are the 4 P's of suburban suffering. First, prerogative. We're called to give up our prerogative, our independence. This is a tough one because we live in America. We are Americans. We live in a society that tells us we can make any decision we want. We decide our actions. Don't tell me what to do. No one tells me what to do. Not my government, not my HOA, not my church leaders. No, I'm free to make any decision I want. As Americans, this is a hard pill to swallow. That's why I'm calling it suffering. See, when you become a Christian, you forfeited your right to make your own decisions. When you accept Christianity only so far as it doesn't affect your autonomy, you're subscribing to a false understanding of Christianity. A false grasp of grace called cheap grace. And cheap grace is when we withdraw grace at our convenience. Cheap grace is when we want to use the parts of the Bible that are the most convenient or easiest to weaponize and ignore the rest. See, the cross destroys me-centric Christianity. You have committed to Christ, not to yourself. Autonomy is idolatry. You're putting yourself before God. If that's your problem, I encourage you to suffer in submission. The second P is pride. Earning and deserving, these are words that do not enter into the Christian vocabulary. So you don't deserve grace any more than anyone else, no matter what sin you've committed or haven't committed, and no matter what sin they have committed or haven't committed. Your better living or sinning less doesn't earn you any more, doesn't make you deserving of any more grace than anybody else. You don't deserve a spot in heaven any more than a murderer or a rapist or a terrorist. See, grace is for those people too, if they accept Christ into their life. They received the exact same grace. Jesus died for them too. See, this is crazy, right? Some people are just better people than others, right? That's the way we think of it. I can think off the top of my head, I can start ranking sins of worst to actually not that big of a deal, no problem, right? But that's not how it works. See, God sees His grace as sufficient for all sins. And this is crazy to think about. It's almost offensive, right? Because it's not how our minds work. We can't help but see others and think that we are better than someone, or see someone else and be jealous because they have what we want. But grace is available for everyone. And it's sufficient for everyone, no matter what. And that's super scandalous for us. Some people say that it's just foolishness. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, "But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles, but to those who God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God." See, this doesn't make sense. It's not fair. It's not right. But that's true. Punishment should fit the crime, right? Forgiveness, grace should have a limit given the egregious nature of certain sins. Matthew 20 says this. Jesus is talking here. "For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them into the vineyard. About 9 in the morning, he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. He told them, 'You also go and work in my vineyard, and I'll pay you whatever's right.' So they went. He went out again at about noon and about 3 in the afternoon and did the same thing. About 5 in the afternoon, he went out and found still others standing around. And he asked them, 'Why have you been standing here all day doing nothing?' 'Because no one has hired us,' they answered. And he said, 'You also go and work in my vineyard.' When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, 'Call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones hired and going on to the first.' The workers who were hired about 5 in the afternoon came and each received a denarius. So when those who came and were hired first, they expected to receive more. But each of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. 'Those who were hired last worked only 1 hour,' they said, 'and you've made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day.' But he answered to them, 'I'm not being unfair to you, friend. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take your pay and go. If I want to give the one who was hired last the same as I gave you, don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I am generous? So the last will be first, and the first will be last.'" See, deserving and earning may make sense in our earthly capitalistic minds, but that's not how God works. That's why this suffering can be difficult as well. The third P is prestige or power or having cultural respectability. Christianity is a call to follow Jesus in ways that are not cool, that are not politically correct, and that sometimes are just plain weird. See, what I'm going to do moving forward, I'm going to use the word cool to represent the world's cultural acceptability, right? To represent what's considered popular in the world. This means if you're striving to look cool in our society and dismissing your Christian values, see, that's not following Jesus well. being cool or wanting to be seen as cool is self-promotion, narcissism. See, Christianity is all about selflessness and altruism. Cool is transcendent and obsessed with the now. Christianity is transcendent, mindful of eternity. Cool is elitist. Christianity is humble. Cool is cynical. Christianity is hopeful. Matthew 20:16 tells us, like we just read, that in Christianity the last shall be first. Now, I'm not saying that if you do the TikTok where you're on a skateboard drinking ocean spray with Fleetwood Mac's song Dreams playing in the background that you're not a good Christian. I'm not saying that. I'm saying I want you to evaluate why you do what you do. Whether you like it or not, Christianity is strange to society. If coolness and prestige are more important to you than God's calling, then your suffering should be on this front. And lastly, I want to look at possessions, right? Our last P of suburban suffering. Jesus says in Matthew 6, don't store up for yourselves treasures in on earth, where moth and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal. And where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. We live in a wealthy society, so this is a tough one. As Christians, we're called to have what's called an open-handed attitude toward money and possessions. It's not yours to start with, and you can't take it with you. And Christianity says to share it and use it for good. Don't hoard it. This applies to our homes as well. There are times that discipleship will call us away from comfortable places to lay our heads, or call us away from a sense of home, or even call us away from our homes. I heard a story last week about a man who spent the last 17 years living half the year in a remote northern part of Africa, outside of a small village. And the whole point was to earn these people's trust. And after he learned their trust, he had to learn their language. And after he learned their language, he had to develop a written language. And then not only develop the written language, but then teach these people to be literate so that eventually, as a linguist, he can get a Bible translated into their language that they can read in a society that is illiterate, 100% Muslim, and have never heard of Jesus. It sounds like a lot of work, and it sounds uncomfortable. See, the kicker is that he's married and has children, right? So sometimes they visit, sometimes they can't. But for 6 months out of the year, for the last 17 years, he's missed time with his family and lived in Africa around these people who aren't really sure what they think about this man. All to be a Christian. All to follow God's call in his life. That brings me to one of the things that Jesus calls our possession that can be tough sometimes. In Matthew 10, he says, anyone who loves their father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves their son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up their cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds their life will lose it. And whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. See, our family is a possession we can't put before God. How's that for sacrifice? How's that for suffering? Now, I'm not saying that we should ignore our family, right? But we should have a balanced understanding of what's important. The last possession I want to talk to you about is our health. See, this has been a bigger deal in our society than it has been the entire time I'm alive now. when you put your health before Christ, it becomes an idol. Look at the people in history who died for their faith. See, Christianity for them was more important. When humanity didn't understand what epidemiology was, or bacteria, or germs, Christians were the ones in the Middle Ages who started hospitals. They started places for sick people to get humane treatment, no matter what was wrong with them. Was that safe for them? No. But Christians have a call to care more about their Savior and about worship and about other people than they do themselves and their own health. However, it's important to trust science and also be cautious knowing what we know now, right? So my point is, if you're working on your relationship, all right, my point is, are you still working on your relationship with Jesus and community while still caring for your own health? Or is it just all about your own health? Jenny says that in this time of craziness, it feels like we as humans are on low power mode, right? Some of our external functions are on power save mode, but I'm asking you to divert some of that power to your relationship with God, your relationship with Jesus, and to care for other people in creative ways. So what possession is your idol? Money, comfort, family, health? What are you putting before God? Some of these things are tough to handle, and I would potentially take the physical pain of martyrdom over having to give up some of the things we just mentioned in these four P's, right? And I'm sure some of you feel the same. I sang a hymn for the some hundredth time on the top of a mountain. For some reason, I couldn't help but hear this verse and not think about this sermon, have it resonate with me. It's from Be Thou My Vision. Riches I heed not, nor man's empty praise. Be thou mine inheritance now and always. Be thou and thou only the first in my heart. O King of heaven, my treasure thou art. I've talked about what suffering looks like in suburban America, but the question still remains, why suffer? What do we have to gain? Before we went to Colorado, I had to officiate a wedding for one of my old students in Florida. And so we flew to Florida to Daytona Beach, and I was performing that wedding. But one of the things while we were there was we went to the beach with my son Thomas. And he loved the waves. He had a blast. And I had a blast watching him enjoy the waves. Part of me was a little nervous because there was a storm brewing way, way off. And so that meant the waves were a little bit harsher than I would have wanted for him. Also meant that the undertow was a little rougher than I wanted it to be. But he was having a blast. And he's letting these waves hit him, and none of them are coming above his knees, maybe his thighs. And he's having a blast with these waves. And I look, and there's a monster wave coming. And there's no time for Thomas to get out of the way. And I see on his face this fleeting look of, maybe this isn't as fun as I thought it was going to be. And as this wave barrels down on him, it smashes him in the chest. It smashes him in the face. It totally crushes him with more power than he knows how to handle. And the only reason that he stayed standing is because right before it hit him, he reached up and grabbed my hand. The salt water got in his mouth. It got in his nose. And as he's spitting and blowing salt water out of his face, he looks up at me with this face that says, oh, this is awful. He looks up at me and says, that was fun. Let's do it again. See, if I had not been standing there the whole time, his attitude would have been completely different. It could have been very, very dangerous. But that's the point, right? No matter what you go through, no matter your suffering, God is with you. Let me say it again. God is with you. Romans 8 says, therefore, there's now no condemnation for those who are in Jesus Christ, because through Jesus Christ, the law of the Spirit who gives life has set you free from the law of sin and death. So if we know that God is with us, we know that our Savior has died for us, and we know that we'll be with our Father when this life is over, how do we handle things in the meantime? Jehoshaphat was a king of Judah, and in 2 Chronicles, we have the story of when he was king, and some of his country, Judah's enemies, joined forces to attack them. When we learn from his actions what we can do in anticipation of suffering, when we get anxious about suffering, and even in the midst of suffering. So 2 Chronicles chapter 20, starting in verse 1. After this, the Moabites and Ammonites and some of the Meunites came to wage war against Jehoshaphat. Some people came and told Jehoshaphat, a vast army is coming against you from Edom, from the other side of the Dead Sea, and it's already at Hazaron Tamar, that is, in Gedi. Alarmed, Jehoshaphat resolved to inquire of the Lord, and he proclaimed a fast for all of Judah. When he found out about this, he gets super anxious, right? And that's okay. But he doesn't prepare for war. He doesn't do anything, really. He admits he doesn't know what to do. He takes a beat and he prepares to hear from the Lord. How many times when we see bad things coming at us, we think, all right, we get anxious, and then we think, I have to jump into action. I have to do something. I have to do this, and I have to do that. And Jehoshaphat goes a different route. He doesn't panic. He admits he's not 100% what to do, and he prepares to hear from the Lord. Verse 5, so then Jehoshaphat stood up in the assembly of Judah and Jerusalem at the temple of the Lord in the front of the new courtyard and said, Lord, the God of our ancestors, are you not the God who is in heaven? You rule over all the kingdoms of the nations. Power and might are in your hand, and no one can withstand you. Our God, did you not drive out inhabitants of this land before your people Israel and give it forever to the descendants of Abraham, your friend? They have lived in it and have built in it a sanctuary for your name, saying, if calamity comes upon us, whether the sword of judgment or plague or famine, we will stand in your presence before this temple that bears your name. We will cry out to you in distress, and you will hear and save us. The next thing that he does is he reminds himself and those around him of all the good that God has done. He reminds them that God is faithful. Sometimes we need to remind ourselves that God is faithful even when we are not. Jumping to verse 12. For we have no power to face this vast enemy that is attacking. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are on you. All the men of Judah and their wives and children and little ones stood there before the Lord. Jehoshaphat puts his eyes on the Lord, and they admit that they don't know what to do. And everyone comes together, men, women, children, they all come together and they stand still before the Lord. And then the Lord speaks to Jehoshaphat. He learns what Judah's supposed to do. And this is his response. Jump into verse 21. After consulting the people, Jehoshaphat appointed men to sing to the Lord and to praise him for the splendor of his holiness. As they went out at the head of the army, saying, give thanks to the Lord. His love endures forever. God tells them they're going to win. So they praise. Not only do they praise, but I was never in the army. I can't tell you a whole lot about it, but singers and musicians are not the people I would put at the very front of my army. But that's what Jehoshaphat does. He puts them there and they sing. They sang praises to the Lord. They admitted they didn't know what to do. They reminded themselves that God is faithful, and they were still in their worship, and they turned their eyes toward God, knowing that he was with them in their trials and in their sufferings. This morning, whether you're struggling with prerogative, pride, prestige, or possessions, or you need to seek out the time to suffer in those things, I want us all to take a cue from Jehoshaphat and all of Judah when he saw the issues on the horizon. I want us to admit to God we don't have all the answers. It's in not knowing the answers that I want to make sure we are reminded of God's faithfulness. Then I want us to assemble in stillness and want to worship with our eyes towards God. So for the rest of this service, let me go ahead and admit it for us now. God, we don't know what to do. We don't have all the answers, and we don't know how to endure the coming sufferings without you. Be with us, Lord. And now, let our participation in communion be our reminder of God's faithfulness. And I want you to sit with your family, men, women, children, get together. I want to sing to God with a stillness in our minds and with our hearts and our eyes held high. God bless.